The lights are on red. We're away.
Hello and welcome to MotoGPOD, the internet radio show about motorcycle road racing. Today is Friday, December 14th, 2007. This is episode number 107, and I am Bob Hayes, your host, here this week, as every week, to talk about things about motorcycles. Not talking a whole lot about MotoGP this week. The news has been fairly slight. What news we've seen coming out has been mostly fluff from MotoGP.com and several of the other places. And it's just been, frankly, it's been a very, very busy week for me. So I haven't had a lot of time to sort of scour the internet and pick up a lot of MotoGP stuff. But one thing that did happen is I got an extraordinary amount of email this past week. The track day segment that I did in my last show generated probably more email than any segment in at least the last several months. Just huge amounts. And thank you very much for all of that. I do appreciate it. I try to answer every email and at least, if nothing else, say thank you. So if I missed your email, I do apologize. But a lot of really, really good stuff, including some very, very long ones. So I'm going to read quite a few of those during this show today because it made for a great topic. And we're going to cover some track day bike further information. We're also going to talk about tips for Indianapolis. I had tips for Laguna Seca, and so we've got some input on tips for Indianapolis that's good stuff. We also have a call with Toby Moody, Eurosport commentator for MotoGP, and we're not talking about MotoGP so much in this one as Toby's experiences doing commentary for the Dakar Rally. And this was kind of a fortunate sort of a confluence of events because I happened to get an email from Alan Waterman talking about the Dakar Rally, and then I happened to get a hold of Toby through just another sort of a situation and kind of turn that into let's do a real quick call about the Dakar Rally. But Alan sent me an email and he says, Bob, I've been thinking about what you said and I had an idea for a show topic for you. Maybe you know this already, but here in the old world, the middle of the MotoGP offseason is interrupted by Rally Sport, the two-week marathon, which is no understatement, that is the Dakar Rally. It's really fantastic to watch for several reasons and particularly possible for MotoGP fans, as although these two competitions are at opposite ends of the motorcycle motorsport spectrum, MotoGP fans that are used to watching racing on billboard table smooth surfaces are astounded to see the ability of these carefully sculptured machines which grace the most beautiful wilderness of northern Africa. I think that you'll really appreciate the YouTube video extract from Eurosport coverage of the 2007 rally. It's 8 minutes and 45 seconds of your life, which I promise will not be wasted unless your other option is going to the bar, of course. Hey, Alan. All right, a man from my own heart. And it gets better and better, perhaps starting slightly slow. And I'm going to put the link up on the MotoGPOD.com website because it's one of these ridiculous YouTube-type links. Or you can go to YouTube and search for Dakar Rally. But either way, it is good stuff, and I think you're going to enjoy the call that we have with Toby talking about his Dakar experiences. Before I get too much farther into the show, I do want to send a big shout-out and a big thank you to David Seabaugh and Clavius Hoffman and an anonymous donor that requested his name not be read out for contributing to MotoGPOD. And David, I actually received David's donation last week, and I should have read it off, but I failed to have my notes sort of handy, so that's why I'm interrupting this one real quick to make sure I say thanks before I kind of get involved and go on and on. Thank you very much, guys. I do appreciate it. Those donations will help with Skype bills or internet hosting or all sorts of things, or even beer, which I've had one where I said thanks a lot and it's going to help with Skype and all that. And then I got an email a little while later. I said, I don't want you to send in using that donation for anything as crazy as paying the bills. This is buy some beer on me. So I appreciate that a lot. I happen to be enjoying a couple of tasty beers, which is probably fairly apparent from the quality of this intro. All right, so moving on, a little bit of some of the other email that we got, a couple of real quickies here. This one is from Ryan Russell in the Philippines, and he says, I'm really bored during the MotoGP season break. Anyway, I'm sending an email to just share something regarding creating a free email account. We all like free. Everything about free is good. And this is actually kind of cool. The website's at sportbikes.com. And on this website, motorcycle addicts like Ryan and like myself and probably like all of you can express our passion for bikes by creating email accounts with a motorcycle brand like domain name. For example, you can create an email account like yourname@duckrider.com or there's also CBRRider.com, other choices, GSXRRider.com, NinjaRider.com, RRRider.com. There's all kinds of them. And they just basically sportbikes.com grabbed up a bunch of cool domain names, and they're doing a sort of a free email thing. And some of them are fairly generic. Some of them are kind of specific, like the ones we read. And they're just a lot cooler, like Ryan says here. He says he thinks that these are cooler than those email addresses with standard sort of Hotmail.com or at Yahoo.com or, God forbid, at AOL.com and all that sort of thing. So check it out, sportbikes.com, and I will, of course, put a direct link to that email page up on the MotoGPOD.com website. But if you'd like to get a free email account there with a kind of a cool domain name, you can do that. And thanks very much to Ryan in the Philippines for pointing that out to us. Then the next little news item we have, and this was sent to me from Harmon, no last name, no first name, just Harmon. And Harmon sent me an information, and nobody else told me about this. I didn't know about this until Harmon sent it to me, and it was news to me, but I think it's great stuff because we've been talking a lot about Nikki Hayden because, as you all know, I'm kind of a Nikki Hayden fan, and not in that kind of girly, ooh, Nikki, sort of way, but just because I think Nikki's a real humble guy and I enjoy following him along. He's got a lot of talent and everything, so I'm kind of a big Nikki Hayden fan. I don't make much of a secret about that. And he says, he's already gotten this 500 times, blah, blah, blah. He says, I just noticed that the first episode of The Kentucky Kid, which if you'll recall is the sort of reality series slash documentary slash informative film, whichever you'd like to call it, about Nikki Hayden. The first episode of The Kentucky Kid is free this week on iTunes. Now, that started just this past Tuesday. Normally, the iTunes kind of cycle goes every Tuesdays. So hopefully you're downloading this podcast on Friday or Monday so that you can go up to iTunes and grab that first episode of that for free. They've divided it up into four chunks. So you get a half hour video for free, and it's high quality video there on iTunes, and normally it costs you $1.99. And even if you ended up having to pay for it, if you haven't seen The Kentucky Kid anywhere else, it's worth, paying $1.99 four times, in my opinion. I've received an email or two that's kind of like, I wouldn't bother watching it because it's kind of popularizing overly, I'm not sure what the word I'm looking for, but overly popular, overly generic, not really a true MotoGP fan thing. It's more aimed at these civilians that aren't necessarily MotoGP fans. But I still thought the show was really excellent. It was good stuff. It's well worth watching, and it's still available on the MTV website, and it's now available on iTunes, so you can watch it easily on your iPod and all that if you have some stuff. And might make a nice, a little Christmas present for somebody. Give them an iTunes gift card. Tell them to go get The Kentucky Kid, that sort of thing. And no, they don't give me a kickback. Actually, if you'd like a really nice Christmas present, make a donation to MotoGPOD in their name, right? But no, thanks very much to Harmon for that. I appreciate the heads up on that one because I didn't know about it. And it's good stuff. High quality there for Nikki Hayden. And let's see, I think that's going to about do it for the long, rambling, mirror pond-induced intro. Why don't we go ahead and get on with the rest of the show and talk about some track day bikes? Like I said in the intro, last week's track day bike sort of buying project that I'm kind of doing right now generated a lot of listener feedback. I got a whole lot of email about it. So I want to cover some of these with you because this is interesting stuff. There's more sort of information coming down the pipe. And we're going to actually talk a little bit more about track bikes and track days and getting into club racing and all that sort of thing because it seems to be a topic that's interesting to us as MotoGPOD listeners. So first of all, this one is a little bit of a downer email. I'm going to go ahead and read it, and I hope Keith is not upset with me. But Keith Cunningham sent me an email, and he says, "Excellent, most timely subject. I was recently injured, broken femur, hand, and other various injuries by a drunk driver when she ran into us coming home from a trip to Calistoga. My Ducati was totaled $26,000 in damages. While healing and waiting for the next Multistrada design, I have been thinking about buying a bike for the track. Thanks for the time on the podcast. It helps me get through the day while in physical therapy. happy. So, Keith, hope that not upsetting you by bringing up your injuries here on the podcast and all that sort of thing, but I do want to wish you a get well soon, and I'm sure everybody else out there does too. So I'm enjoying a tasty Mirapond right now, and I'm raising it to you and hoping that you recover from those injuries real, real soon and do pick up your track bike. So on to other subjects about track bikes that are a little more about buying a track bike. Glavius Hoffman sent me a really long email about several different subjects, and we're going to come back to this email later, but right now we're talking about the track bike section. And Glavius says, being a longtime track day participant, I thought I might add my insights. I actually think that your fifth option of an everyday street bike is a very reasonable option. And if you remember in last week's show, I went through different options of what you might do if you're looking for a bike that's specifically for the track. And one of the options that I suggested was looking at just a straight street bike, generally, you know, preferably used probably, but something that you are going to buy that was a street bike, it has no race prep and all that sort of thing, just turn that into a track bike. And you might even consider salvage titles. Can't remember for sure if I covered that or not, but I know a guy who bought a salvage title bike. He's real happy with it. So you got to be really careful with a salvage title bike, but you can save a lot of money. So talking about buying a street bike, Clavius continues. He says, most of my friends that race, they generally side with Darren in getting a former race bike. And this is not necessarily a bad option, but in my experience, a full-blown race bike is far more bike than most track day riders can handle or fully utilize. It's definitely better than just going out and running and buying a leader bike, which is that classic American mistake, but it's not necessarily always the best idea. So this leads to Clavius' recommendation, which leads to my recommendation. And he says, SV650, 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 and there is 5 exclamation points. He says, I've learned more this past year on my SV650S than on any of my former GSXR 750s, ZX900, or 748Ss. Bigger bikes just cover up bad habits. You might get away with slow corner speed on a big bike, but slow corner speed just is not an option on an SV650, neither is early braking. The SV is a very stable trainer and a very popular platform for a reason. My only regret is not purchasing one earlier. Okay, so it has some shortcomings. The biggest is the suspension and the brakes. Both need to be upgraded. I spent about $1,300 on gold valves and a Penske shock, both of which I highly recommend. I went with a mid-range shock, and the nice thing about Penske's as opposed to Fox or Ohlins is that they are upgradable. You can buy the less expensive model 1 year and then send it out to have it upgraded the next. The brakes are a little lame, but if you upgrade the pads, which Clavius says that he uses EBC-centered pads, upgrade the pads, brake lines, and you get an aftermarket lever, one that allows you to set the lever all the way out. The SV suffers from brake fade. The Pazzo levers are good, but expensive. Lastly, the SV does not hold up well to major engine upgrades, especially the 2003 and higher electronic fuel injection units, which is what I have. The word is to keep the peak horsepower under 80 horsepower. Another great thing about the SV is that it's so economical. I practically made it a whole season on one set of tires, which is shocking. I'd like to see those tires, Clavius. 13 track days on one set of tires, but maybe, you know, I guess you're easier on the tires. And that might be something about the SV650. I got to look into that. He says, that's a big savings. That's a huge savings, folks. I'm lucky if I can get a set of tires to last 2 track days, which leads me to another point. Practice makes perfect. The best dollar spent is not on go fast bling, but good old track time. And this is such a great piece of advice. Sclavia says, a new slip-on exhaust is around $400. That's 2 or more track days. Is 2 to 6 more horsepower really going to make that much of a difference if you don't know how to use it? That's probably the best piece of advice we have out there. So many people out there, they buy a bike, and the first thing you got to do is go and spend a bunch of money on the exhaust. My advice has always been, and I'm not, by the any stretch of the imagination, I'm not the best rider out there or anything like that, but that horsepower, the 2 to 6 horsepower and that additional sound and the cool looks of the exhaust and all that, those are all nice things, but you'd be much better off spending that few hundred dollars on the suspension, because every bike out there can do with some money spent on the suspension. Even your more expensive, the R1s or on up to the $26,000 Ducati and all that sort of thing, there's always something where they're cutting corners on the suspension. So even if you start off with a really great Ohlins suspension, I'm sure you can spend a few bucks more on it and get it even better. And that will be a lot more noticeable of an upgrade than just putting that slip-on exhaust on there. So Thank you very much there, Clavius. That was a good email. I enjoyed that. And SV650, very, very viable option. And I am going to start redirecting some of my efforts to trying to find one. They are popular bikes. And one of the nice things about them being so popular is there's a huge aftermarket. So there is a lot of good stuff you can get, including slip-on exhausts and all that sort of thing for the SV650. So a very popular bike and an excellent thought for a first-day track bike. And next email that we got was from Stuart Sorocki. And I'm hoping I'm not massacring your name there too much, Stuart, but looks like Stuart Sorocki. And he says he's listened to your latest podcast about track bikes. And he says, check out this. It's really interesting. And this is about the 450 Moto. The website is 450moto.blogspot.com, which, of course, I will put on the website because it's kind of pointless to just list off URLs in the podcast. And I actually had an email that scolded me about that. One of the articles on this website was from Motorcyclist Magazine. There's an article from Cycle News. There's all kinds of blog entries. And I do remember seeing this in Motorcyclist. And basically what we're doing here is taking a 450cc dirt bike and putting on street tires and street suspension, all that sort of stuff, slapping on race bodywork. It's a modified RS250 bodywork and turning it into a track bike. This is the father of Supermoto seeks to revolutionize American road racing with a spec series based on 450cc dirt bikes. So I looked into this a little bit, and they've got KX450Fs, they've got CRF450Xs, all sorts of different things like that, and that they're turning into street track bikes rather than just a dirt bike. And this looks like a fantastic idea, and actually probably a better idea than the MotoGP's or Dorna's current plan of the 600cc bikes for the lower class series. They should consider something like this, where you've got an inexpensive bike that you can go out there and do some serious work on and all that sort of thing to make it into a track bike. And it would sell bikes for the factories because they're selling dirt bikes that then people just turn around and turn into track bikes. And it would show a lot of talent. And this is a really, really good idea. And I think that this one might go far. So check out that website. Like I said, I'll put a link up on my website. But if you want to just remember it, it's 450moto.blogspot.com. And like I said, we are going to be covering track days and racing and getting into all that sort of thing a little bit more here in a few future podcasts. It's an interesting topic. It's one that I like, and it seemed to generate a whole lot of listener emails. So I think that's good stuff. All right, moving on to other email ideas that I got. They had a lot of good stuff, like I said, in the email bag this week. Got one from Dave Lama, and he says, I enjoyed your Laguna Seca tips. Can you do a similar show on Indy? I have no plans to attend the California event, but Indy is only 4 or 5 hours from Detroit. My father really wants to attend, but he has some mobility issues. He can walk fine, but he has severely diminished lung capacity, so he gets tired quickly. Any advice would be appreciated. On that's one thing I don't have, is advice for a situation like that. So if you have some advice, why don't you email it to me at bob@motogpod.com, and I will forward it on to Dave. But I do have some other tips, because like sort of perfect storm of email where all kinds of different things happen to come in at this week and come together. I got the question from Dave, and then I got some indie tips from Eric Lawrence. And he says, I was listening to your review of the Laguna Seca GP, particularly in respect to parking and camping and other amenities, and I realized that it was likely that few listeners have ever attended a race at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. As I reside in Speedway, Indiana, and I've been to 35 IndyCar, NASCAR, and Formula One events there at Indianapolis, I thought it'd be nice to give them and you an overview of things that are not included on the Indy MotoGP website to allow better planning while attending the GP next September. This is a great email. It's a lot of information. I'm going to go ahead and read the whole thing. It's a couple pages long, but I think it's good stuff. It's well worth listening to. It's just like Eric's passing on his lessons learned from Indianapolis and going there 35 times. So just like when I was talking about Laguna, this is about Indy. So first of all, weather. The saying that if you don't like the weather, wait 5 minutes and we'll change seems truer here in Indianapolis than anywhere else. And I got to take issue with you on that one, Eric. That's the Oregon saying, but whatever. I digress. Normally, the weather here is pretty mild and sunny with temperatures around 70 degrees Fahrenheit. However, temperatures as low as 40 degrees and high as 95 are not uncommon, with warmer weather happening fairly frequently during the month of September. Bring at least one sweater/sweatshirt and a light to medium rain jacket. jacket and you'll be fine. Camping and parking. The camping and parking sites will be listed below. Grass lots are lot 1A, 1B, and 1C. And basically, folks, if you want me to forward you this email, just send me an email and I will forward it to you. But let's go ahead and cover it here. Grass lots 1A, 1B, 1C, commonly referred to as the Coke lot for the Coca-Cola bottling facility that is located on part of the site. Lot 2, lot 3 grass, lot 4, lot 6 infield parking, and lot 7 are all apparently grass lots, which is okay. Lots 1A, 1B, and 1C are located northwest of the oval, turn 4, and have the largest plots available. Camping starts at 7 a.m. on the Thursday before race day. Area is very flat, but has some low areas, so if rain is possible, try to pick a higher spot. That's actually really good advice. There are a few creeks that run through these lots, so some water will drain very quickly. Lot 1A is the only one that does not have daily parking available. Lot 2 is across Georgetown Road from the main street next to the American Legion Post. Spaces are the same size as Lot 1, very flat as well. Daily parking is allowed. Box trailers and box trucks are not permitted on this lot. Parking opens 7 a.m. on Thursday before race day. Lot 3 grass is across 16th Street from the Oval. Rules are the same as for Lot 2. This area is very flat and has Little Eagle Creek to drain off any rainwater quickly. Lot 4 is to the east of Lot 1A across Georgetown Road. Rules are the same as for Lots 2 and 3. This lot is listed as a family area, and Indianapolis Motor Speedway and the Speedway and Indy Police make every attempt to both keep the typical, you know, night before the race activities out of this area and to keep those that are within this area as family-oriented as possible. Indianapolis Motor Speedway will ask those within the this area to leave if they cannot keep to these rules. The area is flat with no runoff, so any rain puddles will need to evaporate or absorb into the ground. Lot 6 is located near the residential area across from Georgetown Road from the main street, and it's only accessible from Myers Road within the neighborhood. Tent camping, daily camping, and box truck or trailers are not permitted. Also opens at 7 a.m. Thursday prior to the race. Infield parking and lot number 7 are located within the fenced-off area that Indianapolis Motor Speedway owns. Limited free parking on days of track activity is offered, but no camping is allowed. No trucks larger than 1 ton, no box trucks or trailers, no RVs or vans larger than 15 passenger allowed. Lot 3 pavement and 4A premium are asphalt and crushed stone, respectively. Lot 3 pavement is the shopping center parking lot next to lot 3 grass. No box trucks or trailers are permitted, and that lot opens at 7 a.m. Lot 4A premium is on the north side of the access road from lot 4. Space size is 20 by 50. That's big. And there's water and a dump station, so this is perfect for RVs. No daily parking and no tent camping allowed. It opens the same time as lot 3 pavement. Many businesses and residential homeowners allow parking on their property anytime the track is open and vehicles are running, and as the track is surrounded by large areas of homes, the options are endless. The price can vary from $5 to $15 for practice days and higher on race day. Many of the businesses on Crawfordsville Road, just west of the intersection at Georgetown and 16th, allow parking, and there is an elevated area south of Crawfordsville Road, which used to be a rail line, that allows daily parking of almost anything. And there's also RV parking near the fuel holding area along 16th Street next to the active north-south rail line. Okay, so that pretty much covers camping, which in pretty good detail. Thanks, Eric. Motels and hotels. For those of you who are into the motels and hotels thing, somewhat different to the majority of tracks in the United States, IMS is smack dab in the middle of a built-up city, which from all the intersections and stuff we just heard about, yes, is indeed. It is only 10 minutes from the center of a city with a population of almost 1 million people, and hotel and motel accommodation are very abundant. They tend to fill up quickly, though, and they can be somewhat pricey depending on the level of comfort you desire. So basically what we're saying here there is make your reservations now if you plan to go to the MotoGP race in September. Food and drink. As mentioned above, the track is very close to many restaurants, bars, liquor stores, shopping centers, etc. The closest area is in Speedway itself, with a large shopping area on Crawfordsville Road, just east of I-465, that contains two large grocery stores, a CVS drugstore, many fast food restaurants, a number of gas stations, some restaurants and whatnot, and two Starbucks, Quiznos, a liquor store, and more. Wow. For a special experience, visit Dawson's on Main Street. This is a good one. For a special experience, visit Dawson's on Main Street, south of the track, McGilvery's Bar and Union Jack's Pub. And for a great breakfast, go to Charlie Brown's down on Main Street. I think this covers the most important information that's not on the website, and I hope this helps you and the rest of the listeners. And thank you very much, Eric. I think it did. And like I said, if you're going to go to that Indy GP in September, and you'd like me to forward you that email so you have it all there, because it's a little hard to absorb when I'm just reading it off, send me an email, bob@motogpod.com, and I will forward you that email. All right. And one other bit about Indy that we got from Clavius Hoffman as part of his long email that he sent me while he was on a plane ride across the United States. It's like 4 pages long. He says, on to the U.S. MotoGP, although I've already purchased my Indy tickets and I am not planning on going to Laguna, I don't think that it will greatly affect the ticket sales for Laguna. I think that a majority of fans will go to the race that's most convenient for them. He said, I've gone to Laguna for the last 2 years. I've noticed that most of the people I've met at the races are from or are currently living on the West Coast. I am one of the few fans that I know living on the East Coast that have made that trip to Laguna. However, I'm going with a fair contingent of East Coast nutters to the Indy race. I wouldn't say that it won't affect Laguna at all, but I'm just thinking that a glass half full kind of a attitude here. And here's the important bit from Clavius' email. I would definitely recommend the VIP suites. And he's talking specifically at Laguna here, but anything you can glean from this for Indy is also going to help. So I definitely recommend the VIP suites. I was fortunate enough to scam my way into the suites right above the Ducati garage last year for Friday and Saturday at Laguna. It was one of the best experiences of my life. To be that close to such heroes was quite an experience. I was able to get great pre-race photos of Stoner Cavarossi doing Fabio. Yes, Fabio was there showing off his freshly signed valet helmet and the Sky TV girl, as well as the HRC crews scrutinizing the Desmo. I'm still an official corkscrew crazy, so I had to get my seat under the trees for race day, but qualifying was well worth staying in the suite. To watch the qualifying with a live feed and commentary is really quite a treat, not to mention running outside and waving your hands like a lunatic for your friends back home when they cut to shots of the garages. Priceless. So, if you're interested in those VIP suites, either at Indy or at Laguna Seca, don't forget Steve Jones's website at usmotogpfans.com, because he's got quite the sweet deal lined up. I just never get tired of that joke. It never gets old. So I hope that the Indy tips helped a little bit. There we talked quite a bit about camping and some other good stuff. And these are the kind of things that you have to sort of learn. So if this is going to be your first trip to Indianapolis, that information is good stuff. All right, I've got Toby Moody on the phone. Hello, Toby. How are you doing today?
I'm well. You?
No, doing fine. It's winter and the Christmas season and all that's coming up on us, and so it's a bit chilly. But other than that, everything's going just great.
Good. Bit chilly here. Cold snap in the UK at the moment. It's about -6 it was early yesterday morning, but clear skies, which is nice.
Yes, and -6 Celsius for you're talking, right?
Yeah, -6 Fahrenheit. Crikey.
Yeah, so like Michigan.
Yeah, very good. Very good. Yes, I like it.
So another television event that's coming up in the future here is the Dakar Rally, which you were previously involved in, and it still holds sort of quite a bit of excitement for everybody, for motorcycle fans all over, because of the fantastic performances we see from the motorcycle riders in there. So what can you tell us about your sort of experiences with the Dakar, and let's just talk about that a little bit.
Sure. It's an amazing event that I always wanted to do. And I had the opportunity to do it, follow it on the event for 5 years, 2001 through to 05. And it's pretty cheesy to say it changes your life, but it did actually slightly change my life, because it is the most incredible event. It really is one of the last sort of bastions, almost, Bob, of nutty motorsports, you know, a bit like the Baja, except it's 3 weeks, or two and a bit as it is nowadays, but when I started it was, you know, proper 3 weeks, and there is absolutely and utterly no mercy for anybody. Mamby-pamby, oh, safety, mamby-pamby, ooh, let's have an early night, does not exist. But it's a hell of an event, and I was working there for the organizers, a company called ASO, who are French-based, and they hold the rights to the Dakar, And they also hold the rights to things like the Tour de France, Paris-Roubaix cycle race, French Open golf and such like. They're a sporting event company. And they got me to voice the international TV feed every evening from the events, from Paris, the first year I did it, all the way through to Dakar. And it is... It might only be a half-hour show, but there's actually quite a lot of pressure involved because you, as it's being fed out on the satellite to the broadcasters all over the world with the images of the day and the news of the day, I put my voice on top of it there and then. There's no, oh, I made a mistake, can we just rewind the cassette a bit and can I voice that little bit again with that Volkswagen there? No, you got to keep going. It's all in one hit. And it's a very different kind of commentary to doing a live commentary, such as Julian Ryder and myself do at the MotoGP races for Eurosport Television here in Europe. It was a lot of pressure, and it was one hell of an adrenaline buzz. And that was the commentary that you guys saw on Speed TV.
Right, when they used to carry it, yeah. It's now on a network over here called Versus, which used to be the Outdoor Life Network and all of that, and I'm not sure how well their ratings are and all that. But.
Well, I think what happened, Bob, was OLN showed the Tour de France because of the whole Lance Armstrong factor. And I think when you sign up to, as a TV network, if you sign up to show the Tour, you almost have to show the Dakar as well. That's a regular kind of TV thing with some sporting organizations. Yes, you can have this massive great big diamond, but you've also got to do some other stuff as well. And it, and by definition, for the sporting organizer, i.e. ASO, they get instantly another television channel's worth of coverage in another country for the Dakar that otherwise wouldn't necessarily be showing it.
So now, okay, were you traveling along with the rally then through that, or were you recording this back in a studio in Europe?
No, I was on site, on event.
Oh, wow.
And, you know, you sleep in a tent once you get in Africa. In Europe, you just sort of hodgepodge between hotel rooms, but, you know, you don't get to bed till after midnight, and you don't wake up, and you don't get up until... Well, you don't get up. You get up early at sort of 5. I mean, you just sleep as and when you can. And it's actually quite settled once you get into Africa, obviously into Morocco first. And you just have a little tent. I had a 6-foot by 3-foot tent with a blow up bed in it. There's lots of airlines around the place to blow dust out of cameras and such like. And I just blew my airbed up and put my sleeping bag on it and went to sleep. And you get woken up numerous times a night because you're sleeping in the bivouac, which is, you know, it's 1,100, 1,200 people or so, all working on cars, bikes, trucks, aeroplanes coming in and out, cars with no exhausts being run up the road for a test run at midnight or 2 o'clock in the morning. I mean, it's just bonkers. It's brilliantly bonkers.
Yeah, it sounds a bit like a military event.
You know. Well, you take the words out of my mouth because people say, what's the Dakar like? And I say, about, you know, the actual living conditions. And I actually say, you are in the army for 3 weeks. Nobody has any, what's the word I'm looking for, privileges. You are all in it together. It doesn't matter if you are Stefan Pedersen and you've won it 7 or 8 or 9 times before, and it doesn't matter if you're Mr. Little Amateur who gets one night's kip a night, or whether or not you're working as a journalist or TV or as a mechanic or somebody who's involved with, I don't know, the catering or such like. You are all on a level, and that's quite refreshing. It is quite refreshing, and it's good fun. And I did it for 5 years. Unfortunately, I stood down because with, you know, 18 MotoGP races and the other travel that I do around Europe, it's just, these are my sort of months at home, December and now January. So I just wanted a bit of time to myself. But I will go back one day. There's word that in 09 they might go, not go to Dakar again, but go to Egypt across the top of Africa. So it'll be Tunisia, Libya, and Egypt all the way over to Sharm el-Sheikh, which is bordering Iran. and that is one hell of an event. We did that in 03, and it was just stunning. They did a lot of filming for Star Wars out there with the dunes and such like in Libya. Unbelievable scenery. It just gives me goosebumps to think about it. Brilliant. So I'd like to go back one day, and I've got a lot of friends there and a lot of fond memories. So one day, we'll see.
Yeah. How do you shift from, you know, as the whole sort of the logistical effort of moving the bivouac? How do you get from place to place?
The bivouac obviously moves in 24 hours, and not a minute more, not a minute less, the whole cycle. First of all, there's an air traffic control airplane with about 7 or 8 people on, and that arrives into an airstrip first. They have already recced the airstrip. They know how many aircraft are coming, and they know where they're going to park them, so therefore what order they're going to leave the previous bivouac and therefore arrive into the new one. Then there will be a Hercules arrive. That has got 20-something tons off the top of my head of nothing but TV equipment, the editing equipment, the satellite, the uplink, the tents to house the uplink and such like, even the benches on which we sit, even the tables. Obviously, you have to bring everything with it. That arrives, starts to unpack. Other planes arrive, plane full of press, plane full of TV journalists. There will be the catering plane, another plane that's full of the amateurs' equipment, the amateur motorcycle riders. They have a couple of crates that they are allowed to carry their equipment in, spare parts, anything they want, and they are allowed no more. That's one of the restrictions of the amateur class. A plane with organization on, a medical plane, another plane that has got, I said the catering, there'll be another plane full of odds and other things. You know, it goes on. The restriction on aeroplanes is, by definition, the space that's available at the bivouac. So all of the bivouac is then built in the morning whilst the cars are doing the stage and the bikes are doing the stage. And then the competitors begin to arrive at the bivouac. It's the bikes that start first, so they might arrive at 2 o'clock if it's an easy day. They might arrive at 9 o'clock if it's a difficult day. And footage from the stage start to arrive at about, if we're lucky, midday, and then the editors start editing it. The editors actually edit within the Hercules, which is now, in inverted commas, empty, and then they start to edit the program, which is, as I say, half an hour in length, and more and more cassettes arrive by helicopter throughout the afternoon, and the cutoff is 6:15 when the program is on the satellite, and that's when I have to voice it. That's where we work to that point.
Yeah, that's fascinating. Now, have you, when you're watching that half hour edited put together program, you've already seen it once and you're ready for your voiceover, or is it coming through as somewhat of a surprise?
No, I've managed to look at the footage very, very quickly. Sometimes if I'm happy to even look at the footage even at sort of 4 times normal speed, because what I've done during the day is listen to the radio, the chitter-chatter over the radio waves, watched the GPS system, looked at the results that are coming through to the computers that are all, of course, linked back to computers back at headquarters in Paris. But, of course, they're all linked by the satellite links. So that's why the Hercules comes into the bivouac first, because that's our way of communicating with the outside world. And I have made notes on each rider, you know, rider A, rider B, rider C, rider D, and I write notes in my computer of what they've done today. Because if they've arrived in the bivouac, I will run over and speak to them, and they give me information. So I've looked at the footage quick, maybe only 15 minutes beforehand. Then I simulate rider A, rider B, C, and D on my computer, but maybe we see them rider B, D, A, C, E, and F. Maybe we see them in that order. So I quickly assimilate it on my computer as such, and then I read. I don't read an actual script off my computer. I just have bullet points, which is actually the way that I prefer to commentate. And that's what you hear or heard when it was on Speed TV. Same for the bikes, same for the cars, same for the trucks.
Fascinating. That's really great. Interesting sort of to think of the concept, the logistical problems involved with moving such a large, you know, setup by air in fairly primitive conditions and how it all works. That's just amazing.
Mm-hmm. I mean, Bob, sometimes I've started voicing the beginning of the program at 6:15 and we haven't finished editing the back of the program.
Wow.
and if there's an interview, as you may remember, if you know, there's an interview in French, sometimes that interview in French was not in the cut that I saw 15 minutes before we went live, in inverted commas. So one of my colleagues would literally hand me a piece of paper with his scruffy handwriting with a translation into English. And he would sometimes sit next to me with 10 pieces of paper, because we maybe got 10 interviews, therefore 10 translations, and he'd hand me them as they literally came on the screen in front of me, and I would have to, first of all, understand his scruffy handwriting, and then, of course, make the words fit the time of the interview. Say the interview's 47 seconds long. All I just had is a stopwatch in my hand all the time, reset, go, made my words fit 47 seconds so that tried to look professional. Not easy, but a hell of an adrenaline buzz.
I'll bet it was not easy at all. But from what I recall, it always came out very, very polished and quite good when we saw it over here, and I always enjoyed watching it. I need to get Versus so that I can watch it this year with whoever we've got announcing it, because it's a fantastic event. If you haven't seen the Dakar Rally or footage from the Dakar Rally, it is truly amazing. And the classes are everything from motorcycles to all sorts of extreme four wheels.
I mean, it's good because there are no rules. I mean, there are rules, obviously, Bob, but you just feel like there are no rules that are so restrictive, such as even MotoGP or Formula One, particularly restrictive in Formula One. You know, it's like your Pikes Peak Hill Climb. There are no rules.
Right. If you've got a vehicle, there's a class for you. Somehow they'll fit it in.
The thing I find fascinating about the car class on the Dakar is the immense amount of classes. You've got two-wheel drive, diesel, petrol, four-wheel drive, diesel, petrol. You've got a weight limit, different weight limits and such like. I know. Are you light to get across the dunes, but maybe you'll be a bit more fragile? You know, remember Robbie Gordon? He came over with the sort of Baja buggy and such like. And of course, with bikes, you've got the big 950 KTM Twin, the Adventure. You know, that was a big bike, but it only won the Dakar once. Every other Dakar, with a KTM at least, has been won by a single. Whether or not it's a 660, or, of course, stages can be won by 450s nowadays. That 450 technology is just so good. And remembering my last couple of Dakars, the Yamaha 450 had two-wheel drive. When the rear wheel would slip, would spin, it would transfer hydraulic fluid over to the front wheel and give a maximum of 10 or 15% drive to the front wheel. A chap called David Fretigny did it with the Yamaha Moto France entered motorcycle. You know, just it's nice that you could bring these wacky things along, and that's what's good.
Well, all right. I really appreciate you having me on the show, Toby, and thanks for your patience with our technical difficulties there. I'm going to try my own hand at the quick seat of the pants editing to make that seamless. But
no problem. I shall look forward to hearing the final cuts, and you have a good Christmas. Yeah,
yes, you too as well, Toby. Thank you very much.
I will indeed. We'll have a happy MotoGP 2008. It's not far away.
I know, we're counting the days.
Okay, look forward to seeing you again at Laguna, but yes. I'm sure I'll speak to you before then.
Yes, indeed, definitely. All right, thanks, Toby.
Take care, Bob.
It was really nice talking to Toby there on the show about his Dakar experiences. Like we said in the thing, Dakar in the United States is going to be broadcast on the Versus Network. Used to be called Outdoor Life Network. It's one of those cable channels. It's a little unusual on Dish Network. It's in their top tier. You have to be getting whatever their most extreme package is called in order to get Versus. And it's going to be, according to their website, which is quite a giant cluster, let me tell you. The Dakar is the world's most grueling rally. The extreme race pits over 500 teams consisting of both amateurs and professionals against not only each other, but the elements, including those of the Sahara Desert. Covering 5,700 miles, participants driving automobiles, large trucks, and motorcycles will begin the race in Lisbon, Portugal, and finish in Dakar, Senegal. Coverage of the Dakar rally will air daily from January 6th through the 21st at 6:30 p.m., and a race recap is scheduled for the 27th at 4 p.m. Now, those times, I believe, are Eastern. Like I said, their website's pretty much a big cluster, so trying to get the schedule in advance was a little difficult. Looks like the races are the little half-hour race recap show is going to be shown twice a day at Eastern time, 6:30 p.m. and 9:30 p.m., or Pacific time, 3:30 p.m. and 6:30 p.m. So if you got Versus, I encourage you to watch it. It's neat stuff. It really is great. I'm going to put links up on the website to the Versus.com website, and you can figure out the schedule from there and all that. But don't forget, January 6th through the 21st, that's when the Versus coverage is going on. I mentioned earlier in the show about sometimes my notes kind of get overlooked and I meant to say things and then I sort of forget, largely due to the beer, I think. But one thing that I did forget for this show, and I was going to mention it, is that Cycle News magazine had an excellent kind of article going on last week, feature, where they were riding the Ducati, Desmo Sedici, and Hayden's RC212V, and they did a comparison and all that sort of thing. And what's cool about Cycle News right now, Cycle News is a weekly magazine. It's well worth the money to spend just to get the reading material of an actual magazine that you can hold in your hand. But right now they're doing a free sort of preview, and it's been going on for a long time, of an online version. And they're using the same technology that Road Racer X uses for their online version, probably a lot of other magazines. It's actually really well done, a very, very good use of Flash. So I'm going to put up a link to that. Basically, it's the cyclenews.com website. If you kind of go there, you can I'm not sure if there is a link. They might not. Yeah, I think there's a link. There's a link on the cyclenews.com website. And you can always get the latest issue. I'm going to go ahead and put up an issue link for issue number 49, which was last week's issue. And I think my mailman reads Cycle News because I don't get the magazine until like a week after it's supposed to have come out. If it comes out like real, real fast, I'll get it on Saturday. I think they actually mail it out on like Wednesday or Thursday, and I might get it on the Saturday. A lot of the times I'm getting it the following Wednesday. So by the time they're announcing issue number 50, I just picked up issue number 49, the actual print version. But the online version goes up real, real soon. It's free right now, so I encourage you to take a look, cyclenews.com, and I actually encourage you to subscribe to the magazine if you can, because it's got a lot of good stuff. It's a very, very good magazine. So links for that on MotoGPOD.com, and a mental note to Bob, don't forget your notes. All right, that's going to do it for today's show. Hope you enjoyed it. Thank you very much for downloading it. One of the things that I've been learning as I do this podcast is an incredible amount of respect for the guys, the professionals that do this all the time, like Toby Moody and Dave Despain and all this. I mean, I got to tell you that whenever I do a call with Toby Moody, and this is not to sort of knock or denigrate or anything, the calls that I do with anyone else, but the calls that I do with Toby Moody are the easiest to edit by far, because Toby is, you know, he's a professional at this. And so when we sort of have some sort of technical difficulty, like we had a lot of on that call there, that was really bad. I had to cut out a whole lot of stuff, but Toby was great because every time we had a little problem, we'd come back together and get the connection working again. And I'd just sort of say, well, let's take off from this point. And he would just take two, you know, rattle it off. It was easy stuff to edit, and it came out really good. And like I said, one of the things that I would have a problem with is it's like, geez, I'd be running out of the damn studio every 5 minutes to have a beer and have a cigarette break or something. But these guys that do it all the time, they're doing a really, really good job. And not 100% sure where I was going with this. It sort of made sense when I started talking about it. But in any case, thanks very much for listening to this show, and I hope that you enjoyed it, and we'll talk to you next week. This week's disclaimer is brought to you by Andrew Smale. Thanks, Andrew.
MotoGPOD is produced by Bob Hayes, and I'm solely responsible for its content. MotoGP is a trademark of Dorna Sports SL. The MotoGPOD podcast and MotoGPOD.com are not affiliated with Dorna Sports SL. All other trademarks are the property of their respective owners, and MotoGPOD is not affiliated with any of them.